now. Wind is from the north at 3. Humidity is at 83%. 58 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today, of course, marks the 75th anniversary of D-Day. And because of that, we are rebroadcasting a Morning Show conversation from 2013 with the author of a very important book about General Dwight D. Eisenhower. We are spending this portion of the Morning Show examining one of the most important figures of the 20th century, and someone with whom we're still trying to really come to grips and fully understand. His name, Dwight D. Eisenhower. Of course, a former United States president, an exceedingly important general during the waging of the Second World War, and a figure who affected the course of history for our country and indeed for the world in ways that we even to this day maybe still do not fully appreciate and understand. A sprawling new biography of him has just been written by Gene Edward Smith, who is rightly acclaimed for his marvelous book about Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And he is a member of the faculty at the University of Toronto, was for 35 years, and at Marshall University for a dozen years. Currently a senior scholar in the history department at Columbia University. And again, his new book is called Eisenhower in War and Peace. It's published by Random House. Gene Edward Smith, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you so much.
The very first sentence of the book in the preface says, Dwight Eisenhower remains an enigma. We probably could spend the next 25 minutes just having you explain that sentence, but in brief, what leads you to begin this important story in this way?
Well, it seems to me that Eisenhower is one of the most underrated presidents in American history. Everything that Eisenhower did, he made look easy. And that's why, in many respects, his accomplishments have sort of been diminished by interpreters of the period. Eisenhower made peace in Korea when no one thought that was possible. He twice refused to use nuclear weapons when the Joint Chiefs and his advisors on the National Security Council urged him to do so. He built the interstate highway system in the United States and the St. Lawrence Seaway. He added 10 million people to the Social Security rolls. These were people independent, who worked independently, like doctors and lawyers and accountants. His accomplishments as president are just incredible. And as a military leader, he was the supreme commander of the largest coalition army ever assembled during World War II. So these are extraordinary. And because of Eisenhower's personal demeanor and style, he made all of these things look easy.
Hmm. And that's why your biography, of course, is so valuable to us, because it takes us, in a sense, beneath the surface in such effective fashion. A couple other things that are quite intriguing from this preface that I want to ask you about. As we look back at President Eisenhower, you say he may have been the last president to actually believe in the Constitution. What are you saying there?
Well, Eisenhower genuinely believed that it was up to Congress to pass laws and determine policy, and that his job as president was to execute that policy. I think that was really what I was getting at, that beginning with John Kennedy, I think, afterwards, and most of President Kennedy's successors have believed that the formation of policy was really their responsibility. Ike took a different view. He believed that was Congress's job, although I must say that he did his best to influence Congress.
As you wrote this book, I must say, as I read it, I am profoundly impressed by the lack of bias. That is, we'll read one page and we are being told glowing accounts of Dwight D. Eisenhower's greatness, and then we'll turn the page and there will be a very frank account of some misstep or some personal demon or some other way in which he fell short of what we think of as complete greatness. I'm very impressed by your even-handedness.
Please, go ahead.
I was just going to ask if that, for someone in your line of work as a historian, comes naturally, or if that is something that requires, in a sense, supreme conscious effort to not allow any personal bias you might have about the man or about the president or about the general swaying things in terms of how you draw your portrait of this man.
Well, it doesn't come naturally, but it's something you really have to work on. And I guess having written five biographies, I have tried to develop that habit of looking at things objectively. And one of the biggest problems, I think, for a biographer, if there's something bad there, you have developed such a relationship with the person about whom you're writing that often you're inclined to diminish it or to conceal it, and really that doesn't give an objective portrait of the person involved. And so it's important to bring out the warts as it is to dwell on the individual's accomplishments. And I've tried to do that. I must say, writing about Eisenhower is much different from writing about Franklin Roosevelt, because Eisenhower was very much of a private person, whereas FDR, most of it was on the surface. If I could just say one other thing, when I started writing about Eisenhower back 5 years ago, I told my wife we were going to have to go out to Abilene, Kansas, and stay there for about 7 or 8 months while I exhausted the resources in the Eisenhower Library. And she wasn't too fond of that. She said, "Gene, why don't you write a biography of De Gaulle?"
And head off to Paris.
Exactly.
We're speaking with...
That may be next.
We're speaking with Gene Edward Smith. We're talking about his brand new book, which is called Eisenhower in War and Peace. You give us some account of the childhood of Dwight D. Eisenhower, the rather limited economic resources of his family. I mean, actually, downright poverty at certain points in time. But really, the first incredible thing I read in this portion of the book was when you said that if it hadn't been for athletics, it's very questionable whether young Dwight D. Eisenhower would have completed his 4 years at West Point. It's really amazing to think about how his life, and for that matter, sort of the chart of world history, might have been radically altered if events had not gone as they had at West Point.
Well, Eisenhower looked at West Point a little bit like Grant and Pershing did. They went there for an education, very much unlike the attitude of Douglas MacArthur and George Patton, who went in search of military glory. For Eisenhower, he and Grant, they could take the army or leave it at that point in their lives, and it was the athletics and the camaraderie that kept Ike at West Point, and he did very well. One of the curious things, Ike received a serious knee injury as he was playing football and couldn't play for the last 2 years that he was at West Point, but he became head cheerleader at West Point. Curiously, Franklin Roosevelt was head cheerleader at Harvard. Ronald Reagan was head cheerleader at Eureka College. And George W. Bush was head cheerleader at Andover. It's curious.
It sure is. In the chapter of your book called The Great War, in which we find out about Eisenhower's experiences during what we now call the First World War, one of the most interesting and insightful statements you make is the fact that Dwight D. Eisenhower missed seeing, in a sense, actual combat in the First World War. Didn't miss it by much, but essentially the war ended before he was actually out on the battlefield. You say that this, in fact, might have been of profound importance in terms of what kind of a general he was and how he led during the Second World War.
I think that's true. It's a little introverted argument, but the people who served in the trenches in World War I really understood it firsthand, the severity of the sacrifice and what was involved, and particularly among the British officers who saw much more of it, that made them very reluctant to perhaps to risk men's lives unnecessarily. Not having seen that, I think Eisenhower looked at it somewhat more abstractly and was therefore able to commit troops to battle with less reluctance, perhaps, than if he had been in the trenches night after night after night in the First World War.
And haunted by those kind of images. You write, unlike many British senior commanders, Eisenhower had not been shocked into excessive caution by the futile slaughter of World War I. He was ready for a war of maneuver, and his early experience with America's nascent tank corps perhaps prepared him far better than a year in the trenches would have done.
I think that's correct. Eisenhower spent, as you mentioned, World War I at Gettysburg at the Army's Tank Training Center. He was the commander of that. He was graduated from West Point in 1915, and he was one of three members of his class who rose as high as the rank of lieutenant colonel. Only three of them did, and then after the war, he was reduced to the rank of major and stayed in that rank for 16 years. Promotions in the Army in those days were strictly by seniority, and Eisenhower's turn didn't come up until 16 years later, so he was for 16 years a major in the Army.
During the chapter called The Peacetime Army, where we chart his life between the world wars, this is where we learn some of the most interesting things about the marriage between Dwight D. Eisenhower and his wife, Mamie Dowd. And one facet of their marriage I don't remember hearing much about was the very sad death of their first son, which you say was an event that seems to have dramatically and perhaps permanently altered the chemistry between husband and wife.
I think so. I think each one secretly, in some respects, blamed the other. It was the child was named Ike. He was a little over three years old. He died of scarlet fever when Ike was stationed at Fort Meade in Maryland. And I think the marriage was never the same. Was never the same after that. They both took it very hard, particularly Eisenhower. And there was just nothing they could do. The medical profession was such at the time that there was just nothing that they could do to save the child. And that it was a traumatic moment for both of them.
Right. We should maybe mention that in charting their relationship, their marriage, and some of its difficulties, that you, in a sense, have only half of what you would want to have. That is, you have the letters that the one sent to the other, but not the other letters. And this is sort of an intriguing situation in and of itself.
That's correct. In the 1980s, when Kay Summersby published her second book called Past Forgetting, My Love Affair with Dwight D. Eisenhower, John Eisenhower, the president's son, shortly after that, published a book called Letters to Mamie, which were Ike's letters to his wife during World War II. Strangely, Mamie's letters to Ike not only have never been published, but it's not exactly clear where they are. John says that they don't exist, and it's difficult to believe, but anyway, we certainly don't know of their existence at this point. But clearly, many of Ike's letters were written in reply to Mamie's letters to him. And for some reason, I have a feeling that it was that the John may have felt it was best to dispose of those.
Hmm. As we chart those later years between the wars, among other things, you tell us that Dwight D. Eisenhower, in the wake of the stock market crash and the Great Depression, became caught up in the excitement of the New Deal. And it helps us understand that Eisenhower, at least in some respects, was a very complicated mix of philosophies. I mean, conservative in some ways, quite progressive in others.
That's right. But I think most importantly, Eisenhower was extremely intelligent and had the ability to grow as he was exposed to new situations. I think he began from a very, very conservative standpoint, as the professional army during the interwar years were. And during his time in Washington, I think changed considerably. And as he was exposed to new situations, as during World War II, as he was exposed to the British and the French, he changed a great deal. And he was able to mature. He was never wedded to ideas of a previous age.
Hmm. You write, as he saw more of the world, as he dealt with policy issues, he learned to appreciate a diversity of viewpoints and to value the intrinsic individuality of Western society. What set him apart from some of his regular Army contemporaries was Eisenhower's ability to absorb the lessons around him and broaden his outlook.
Well, that's absolutely correct, and I would stand by that paragraph forever.
We're speaking with Gene Edward Smith about his book, Eisenhower in War and Peace. And we should add that, I mean, it's hard to know where to begin or where to end in a biography that spans more than 900 pages. But, of course, I mean,
that includes Index.
Right, of course. But I mean, it's a fascinating book, and some of the most interesting chapters deal with those chapters of his life and career that many of us know very little about, like, for instance, the time he spent in the Philippines with Douglas MacArthur in the 1930s. But with time already receding here rapidly, I think we should move to the Second World War. And one of the things you say about Eisenhower as you chart his significance is sort of differentiating between, in a sense, different kinds of military leadership. And the fact that Eisenhower was in many respects ideally suited to be the supreme commander, but on the other hand, on sort of a level down from that, when it came to the nuts and bolts strategies of the battlefield, that would be a kind of leadership in which he was much more limited.
That's absolutely correct. The French have expressed it marvelously. They say that Eisenhower was the right man in the right place at the right time, and that would be for the supreme commander, for handling a coalition army that included the French and the British and the Canadians as well as the Americans. And all of Eisenhower's principal deputies were British throughout the war. But Eisenhower was uniquely able to bring all of those people together to keep them fighting in the same direction, really, and to set the overall strategy and then leave it to them to carry out that strategy on the battlefield. Men like Patton and Montgomery, who were far better off, far better battlefield commanders than Ike, but who would have been impossible. It would have been impossible for them to do the job that Ike did.
Among the insights you share is that when it came to a very important decision, that is, for the Allies to invade North Africa in 1942 rather than attempting a cross-channel attack on the European continent, you call this the most far-reaching American strategic decision of the war. And this was one that Roosevelt was responsible for. I had never heard this spelled out so clearly. Briefly explain why this was such a crucial decision in the Second World War.
Well, the War Department and the Army General Staff assumed that they could invade Germany or invade France across the Channel in late 1942, which was just absurd. The American Army wasn't nearly ready for that, and the Germans were far stronger in 1942 than they were in 1944. It was just a pipe dream, and FDR was insistent that the United States come to grips with the Germans during 1942. Don't forget, the Germans didn't attack Pearl Harbor. The Japanese did. And Roosevelt, nevertheless, made Germany the principal enemy for the United States. And in order to be able to carry that through, he needed the Army to come to grips with the Germans someplace in 1942. And when it turned out that it was impossible to cross the Channel, then North Africa simply emerged by default, and the invasion followed. And the North African campaign was really a learning experience, both for the American Army and for Eisenhower. They clearly showed that they were just would have been totally unprepared to invade Europe at that time. But I think what I was suggesting by the crucial decision, it goes back to Pearl Harbor and the fact that it was the Japanese who attacked the United States. Roosevelt reversed American policy and made Germany the number one enemy, and we came to grips with it with the invasion of North Africa.
During those years of the Second World War, of course, there are all kinds of relationships that are worth exploring, and you do it quite thoroughly. His relationship, for instance, with American generals like Patton or Omar Bradley or General Marshall. His relationship with British General Montgomery or Prime Minister Winston Churchill. And, of course, you do not shy away from what is, of course, a matter of incredible complexity and delicacy, and that is this woman, Kay Summersby, with whom Eisenhower had a very close relationship and some ventured to believe an out-and-out affair. I wonder if you could, without us trying to summarize something so complicated in just a few moments, I wonder if you could just say a word about the challenge of writing about this enigma.
Well, the challenge begins with trying to determine what the facts were. And this is a trail that's been muddied by various people for a long time to conceal various things. And it really required a great deal of effort to try to piece things together. And as best I could do, it seemed to me that this was a very loving relationship. This was a wartime romance that existed for 3 years, and it ended abruptly when the war was over. But I don't think one should diminish the passion of this relationship. Kay was not really his driver. Kay drove him initially for 2 weeks when he was in London, but his driver throughout the war and afterwards was Sergeant Leonard Dry in the United States Army. And Sergeant Dry was always offended when Kay was called Ike's driver. Kay was Eisenhower's associate. And it was a very close relationship. It wasn't that unusual. Patton had a relationship. Beetle Smith had a relationship. Everett Hughes at Eisenhower's headquarters had a relationship. The leading generals at MacArthur's headquarters had relationships. This was not at all unusual. This was war. These men were overseas. But by and large, the relationships didn't continue after that. And it was not all that unusual, I think.
Mm. Ultimately, of course, Eisenhower returns with great acclaim. For some years, is the head of Columbia University, an experience which begins promisingly and does not end all that well. And, of course, ultimately, Dwight D. Eisenhower becomes president of the United States. And what is so intriguing is, although many people would thought of him as kind of an average Joe and first of all General Eisenhower, who then became president, you tell us time and again that in fact politics came very naturally to Eisenhower, and in many respects he was a master.
He was a master at politics, particularly because he always concealed his hand. Professor Fred Greenstein at Princeton has a nice little book, The Hidden Hand Presidency, about Eisenhower. He was always careful not to show his hand and to be behind the scenes. During the Army-McCarthy hearings, for example, Eisenhower was calling the plays for the Army throughout that. But he didn't want to come to grips directly with McCarthy. I think he told his brother, "I don't want to get into a pissing contest with a skunk." And but Eisenhower was clearly calling the plays from behind, and he orchestrated the Army's response, and ultimately the Senate's vote of censure for the Wisconsin senator. Yes.
You call Eisenhower a true professional in this sense. Like a true professional, Eisenhower made things look easy. He was a master of the essentials. He knew instinctively which matters required his attention and which could be delegated to subordinates. I mean, this is part of why we tend to underestimate how good a president he was. Could you just say a word about an unsealed envelope which ended up on his desk early in his first term?
I was thinking about that as you were speaking. Just after the inaugural parade, Eisenhower went into the White House for the first time as president. The chief usher gave him an unsealed envelope, and Eisenhower addressed to Eisenhower, and Eisenhower handed it back to him and said, "Never give me a sealed envelope again. That someone on the staff should be reading these things and only giving me what is important for me to see." It was a teaching opportunity for Eisenhower and the White House staff at that point.
Very much so. And, of course, you go on to explore his health setbacks, the important work which he did on our interstate highway system, the way in which he confronted the situation with the Suez Canal in 1956. As you explore all of these facets and more of the Eisenhower presidency, one thing really leapt out at me at the start of one chapter when you mentioned that Eisenhower, like the Roosevelt, like the Eisenhowers, like the Roosevelts, were accustomed to servants. When Eisenhower got out of bed each morning, Sergeant Money held the president's undershorts for him to step into. And you go on to list some other things as well. I only mention that because as I read that, I was astonished on a couple of different levels, I suppose, but mostly that was so at odds with the way that everybody viewed Dwight D. Eisenhower, Ike, the guy we like. We never would have thought of him as someone accustomed to that kind of life of privilege.
I'm not sure it was a life of privilege, but it was a life of personal support. He had been in the Army, and really from 1941 on, as a senior general that he became, he was accustomed to a large personal staff who drove him, who dressed him, who took care of all of his creature comfort needs. When Eisenhower left the White House, he not only had to learn to drive, he had to learn to dial a telephone. We were back in the dial telephone days then, and Ike didn't know how to dial a telephone. He had all that personal support, but again, that freed him. It wasn't luxury. It simply freed him from the details of daily life that allowed him to concentrate on larger issues.
I'm glad you clarified that, because I actually came away from that paragraph kind of thinking it in more the way that I had framed it. So you have helped me understand that point much more correctly. And for any of our listeners who will end up seeking out your book, ultimately, as you came to the end of this odyssey of writing such a thoroughly researched biography of this intriguing man, do you feel like you came away profoundly surprised by anything about Dwight D. Eisenhower?
I wouldn't say surprised, but I think it's terribly impressed by his accomplishments, which were far greater than I had anticipated when I began to write. His intervention in Little Rock during the desegregation crisis in Little Rock, when he sent the 101st Airborne Division in, if Ike hadn't done that, if he hadn't responded with overwhelming force to enforce the district court's order, desegregation in the United States would have been set back one or two generations. He was telegraphing to the South that this was the law of the land, and the federal government was going to enforce it.
Well, that and many other fascinating moments and chapters in this long life and important career, military and political, of Dwight D. Eisenhower, who, by so many different benchmarks, remains one of the most extraordinarily successful presidents in our nation's history. The book, Eisenhower in War and Peace, published by Random House. Gene Edward Smith, my thanks to you for writing this fascinating book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Thank you so much.
The time is 8:39. You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We turn now to the Morning Show archives for yet another interview, this one dating from 2004. Over the weekend, I have been devouring a tremendously interesting book called Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime, from the Sedition Act of 1798 to the War on Terrorism, written by someone who lives actually just down the road, Jeffrey R. Stone, who is the professor of law at the University of Chicago and was dean of the law school there 1987 to 1994 and provost of the university from 1994 to 2002. And this a very interesting book examines throughout American history those times of war in which free speech has been imperiled in one way or another. And I'm grateful that Professor Stone can join us for a few minutes to talk about his superbly crafted book, which has just been released and published by W.W. Norton. Professor Jeffrey Stone, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
You have really undertaken quite a challenge here in that you talk about the late 18th century, the Civil War, the two World Wars, the Cold War, the Vietnam era, taking us up to the present day. Another decision you could have made was to take any one of those chapters from our history and examined this. You have taken on instead the challenge of trying to view this comprehensively through all of American history. What led you to do that?
Well, I wanted to understand better how we behaved in past episodes that were somewhat like the present, to see whether there were lessons that we could learn from those episodes, particularly with respect to civil liberties and free speech, and therefore be able to handle the current situation perhaps in a better way. And I did find, in fact, as the book makes clear, that there are important common themes and that there are lots of lessons we can learn, and it's very important for us to do so.
But the other thing, of course, that's interesting is that as these various times of war have unfolded, free speech has not been imperiled in exactly the same way. I mean, that it's not just a matter of changing the dates and a couple of little details. I mean, there are sometimes very striking differences in the way these events play out.
Right. The most dramatic ways in which free speech has been attacked would have made it unlawful in the United States for Howard Dean to criticize the war in Iraq during 2004, and he would have been put in jail for criticizing the Bush administration's conduct of the war in Iraq if this were 1798 or 1863 or 1917. So throughout much of our history, it was a criminal offense, even for a legitimate national leader, to criticize the war, to criticize the administration in the conduct of a military action. That's the most direct form. Other ways in which government over time has come to attempt to deal with the problem, what it perceives as the problem of dissent, have been much more through indirection. There have been blacklisting. There have been legislative investigations during the McCarthy period that were designed to humiliate and to embarrass people. There is surveillance during the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, and again, I think to some degree today, widespread investigations of political and religious organizations by the government. There's been efforts to manage dissent by controlling the opportunities for criticism, by creating free speech zones and so on. So there's lots of different ways in which the government can attempt to shield itself from its critics.
One of the things you do in the book is you try to set the stage by helping us understand exactly what sort of free speech Americans are ideally entitled to, and some of the benefit to us collectively as a society when free speech is allowed to flourish. I think one of the most interesting moments is when you say it is
indispensable for creating the kind of environment in which individuals can develop the capacity to deal with sharp differences of opinion, perspective, understanding. It promotes traits such as tolerance, skepticism, personal responsibility, curiosity, distrust of authority, independence of mind. All those things which I think many people would believe are indispensable to a well-functioning democracy.
Right. One of the critical features of a self-governing society is that citizens think of themselves as the governors, and they think of their elected officials as their representatives who are ultimately accountable to them. And although we now pretty much take that for granted, it's very important to understand how foreign that is in world history and even how foreign it was to those who created our government. In the late 18th century, when our Constitution was adopted, this was truly an experiment. Those who put this government into place had no precedent on which to rely. And the idea of individuals who would see themselves as essentially the ones who were ultimately responsible for the government's actions was a very bold and very dangerous experiment. And there's a great analogy, because if you think of what we're trying to do in Iraq today, to create democracy in Iraq does not mean just giving them voting booths. It means creating in them exactly those individual character traits that you just listed, because those are essential for them to be able responsibly to handle the realities of living in a democracy. It means being willing to lose and accept the rules of the system and know that you'll have a chance to come back another time. Those who voted for John Kerry and lost in 2004 may go home, they lick their wounds, they complain to their friends, and then they say, well, okay, how are we going to do better in 2008? That's not the way the world operates in most parts of world history. And those characteristics are fundamental to our democracy, and the First Amendment is critical in instilling in individuals those characteristics that enable us to succeed as a self-governing society.
And they're not built in a day.
That's right. They take a long time.
The book is especially helpful, I think, to those of us that don't know early American history as well as we should. So in some of what emerged during, for instance, the presidency of our second president, John Adams, I'm just curious. I was amazed that there was as much detail available to you as a researcher. Clearly, there must be detailed records of court proceedings and congressional hearings and so on from which you can draw to give us some sense of the rancorous disagreement which occurred over the issue of free speech.
Yeah, there are wonderful records from that period, including the court opinions and all of the legislative debates and a great many newspapers. So it is possible to recreate that time very well. Plus, there's a lot of primary sources that have been used already by other scholars. So this material is actually quite accessible. And it was a quite remarkable period. I mean, partly because of the fact that this was an experiment and they had no idea how this was going to work out. The very first challenge that they faced was that the framers of the Constitution did not envision political parties. Indeed, they were very frightened of the prospect of political parties because they thought that would create divisions that would ultimately cause the nation to fall apart. And yet, almost immediately, these political parties emerged, as we would understand today quite naturally. It would be hard for us to imagine Iraq, for example, without political parties. But they didn't understand that. And so one of the things that happened is the United States divided into these two parties, the Federalists, led by Adams and Alexander Hamilton, which tended to represent the wealthier class, the more stable group of society, those who sought to preserve security at a premium, and the Jeffersonians, led by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, who tended to be much more representatives of the common man, believed much more in democracy, and were willing to take certain risks of security in order to preserve liberty. And these two groups, which represented North and South, mercantilists versus farmers, found themselves very much at odds with one another. And in the 1796 presidential election, John Adams had won only by 3 electoral votes over Thomas Jefferson. And the 1800 election loomed as the first time in American history that there might be a change in the national leadership based upon an election. And nobody knew what was going to happen, if that's what happened in the outcome. And both sides believed that there could well be a civil war. The Federalists, to protect themselves against the possibility of Jefferson winning, enacted the Alien and Sedition Act of 1798 on the guise of protecting the country against a potential war with France, but which essentially made it a criminal offense for any person to criticize John Adams. And as a result, all of the leading Republican editors, newspaper editors, were put in jail. And the effort of the Federalists was essentially to put the Republican Party, the Jefferson Party, out of business. The American people, to their great credit, rebelled against that. They elected Jefferson in 1800. And to the great credit of the people at that era, the Federalists gave over the power of the government to the Republicans. And it was the first peaceful transfer of political power in any nation in thousands of years.
You mentioned the fact that, that comes up more than once, that in some of those chapters of our history where we have maybe most egregiously compromised the idea of free speech, that almost always there has been a real backlash then the other direction, that the American public eventually realizes what is being, in effect, taken away from them, and we will see a swing the other direction and a more hearty and maybe appreciative embrace of what free speech and free expression is all about.
Exactly right. What happens after each of these episodes is that 3 years, 5 years later, the public sort of has this curtain raised and looks back and says, why did we do that? That was horrible. We have to make sure we never do that again, and we have to really be much more careful. And it was that judgment, that by judgment of the American people, that in each of these episodes we overreacted and we did things that were excessive and that we regretted, that really leads me to believe that it's very important to try to avoid doing those same kinds of things again in the future. And there is a good side to it. I do think that the excesses that occurred in these periods have caused people to think harder about civil liberties and constitutional rights, and therefore to become, if anything, perhaps even more committed to them. But the problem also is that we're talking about long periods of time here, and so one generation's lessons are often forgotten by the time we get to the next generation.
Speaking of generations, I pride myself on knowing a fair amount about Abraham Lincoln, but I did not know an interesting story which you tell about him, about how as he first came to Washington as a U.S. congressman from Illinois, he took serious exception with President James K. Polk and the way that the United States had gotten into the Mexican War. And his spirited attack on President Polk, in a sense, comes back to haunt him when he himself as president is brutally attacked by Americans during the Civil War. I mean, those who took exception with how he was waging that war. That was a fascinating examination of how history can sort of turn upon itself in some very unexpected and fascinating ways.
And I think also about how Lincoln himself was able to learn a lesson from the past, from his own personal past. Because Lincoln, who did, as you say, strongly criticized Polk during the Mexican War and lost his bid for re-election completely as a result of that criticism. And then a decade later winds up being president of the United States, subjected to more vituperation than any other president in American history from people in the North during the Civil War. Nonetheless, remains for the most part truly committed to the principle of free speech. Of all the wartime presidents we've had, I think Lincoln, despite the fair criticism of Lincoln for his suspensions of habeas corpus, I think on the free speech front, Lincoln actually comes across quite well. I mean, he does, I think, seem to have learned the lesson from his own experience of having been a critic of a war and suffered for that criticism, that there is a need to tolerate criticism to the greatest extent possible. And so Lincoln is really quite an interesting figure, not only in all of the other ways, but also in particular in the way in which he deals with his personal dilemma during the Civil War.
Yeah, and the way he wrestles with this is on a fairly profound level.
He demonstrates that during the Civil War, in this very famous case involving Clement Vallandigham, who was the leader of the Peace Democrats, the Democrats who opposed the Union fighting the war. Rather, their view was to let the South secede if it came to that. Vallandigham was arrested and prosecuted and convicted, and his supporters appealed to Lincoln, and Lincoln wrote a series of public letters trying to explain his thinking about free speech in wartime. And they were, I think, among the most profound writings of the 19th century on free speech. And it was impressive to see Lincoln not only as a master politician, but also as a really first-rate constitutional lawyer.
I also appreciated the fact that you really help us understand the precarious state of the Union as the Civil War began. You say that Lincoln was desperate to nurture the precarious loyalty of Delaware, Maryland, Kentucky, and Missouri. Those were four slave states who had not yet seceded. And if they left the Union, that was really going to create very serious awkwardness and a whole shift in the balance of power. I mean, it was under really frightening circumstances that the war between the states began. And it's little wonder that Lincoln and others were really tempted to do whatever they could to generate just as much loyalty as they possibly could, even if that meant a curbing of certain civil liberties.
Right, or in some cases not curbing certain liberties. Because one of the things that led Lincoln to be tolerant of dissent was that he didn't want to alienate the border states. And there were good political reasons from that standpoint for allowing the dissent to take place rather than suppressing it and then having those states turn against him. And one of the things I wanted to do in the book was not to look at these issues as abstract legal issues, but to really put them in their historical context and to try to make them real for the reader as they were for the people who lived through them. And so trying to create a sense of what the wartime atmosphere was like is critical, I think, in understanding why the majority, why the government behaved the way it did in each of these episodes, not just the Civil War, but the degree of anxiety and fear and sometimes hysteria, and also the opportunism sometimes of politicians to take advantage of these circumstances to exacerbate the fear in order to further their own partisan ends was also an important part of understanding what happened in many of these situations.
And that certainly occurs more often than not during wartime.
Right. It's very common that politicians see the opportunity of a frightened public to step forward as a savior and to identify enemies within as a way of saying, I can protect you against these enemies from within and others cannot. And, of course, the Cold War period with Joseph McCarthy is one of the great examples of that, where people like McCarthy, not only McCarthy, but Nixon and others, essentially dramatically inflated the danger to the United States from internal subversion and then painted themselves as the only ones who could protect Americans from this internal cancer. And it was very effective. And for more than a decade, it enabled them to essentially control national politics.
Mm. One last question. You mentioned risk. And at one point you say that part of this issue is of balancing two competing risks. On the one hand, the risk that if all ideas are out there, then sometimes the public embraces bad ideas, so to speak. But if there is too much oppression over all of this, then no ideas at all get embraced or fully debated and deliberated upon. So where do you see that healthiest balancing point being between these competing ideas?
Well, I think the single most important element of American democracy is that the people must have the capacity to decide for themselves on all issues relating to public policy, and that government may never shut off exposure to ideas or opinions or information because the government doesn't trust the citizens to have access to that information. And that's a very profound and very important point about American democracy. It has confidence in the people. That is really the bedrock of the United States Constitution. It is we the people. It is not the government. It's we the people that is ultimately responsible for making the most fundamental decisions, and that means that we the people have to have access to that information. So it is only in the most extreme circumstances that the government, I think, can prevent individuals from hearing opinions or ideas or getting information. They almost never occur. It's the kind of example of how to build a hydrogen bomb with technical information being given or disclosing the names of CIA covert agents. But only in those kind of very narrow, rare circumstances should the government have the ability to step in. Beyond that, it is fundamental in our society that people have a right and a responsibility to learn and to know and to think.
As you say that, I'm struck by sort of the double meaning, which I'm sure is not accidental, of the title of your book, Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime. And, of course, the peril which we immediately think of is the peril of wartime. But you speak of how perilous it is when for whatever reason, the government would seek to curb these civil liberties that we are talking about.
That's exactly right. It was intended. I'm glad you caught that. It was intended to be a double entendre on both the peril posed by the war and the peril posed by the response to the war.
The book, again, is Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime, from the Sedition Act of 1798 to the War on Terrorism, published by W.W. Norton and Company. Its author, Jeffrey Stone. Jeffrey Stone, I thank you so much for joining us today on The Morning Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Bye.